Sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha vidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Om. Very good. Welcome back. Welcome also to the many students attending this class online. We continue in chapter 23. By the way, this is the penultimate chapter of the Uddhava Gita. One chapter follows, but this is a heavy chapter. Heavy in a sense that it's pure Vedanta. So Sri Krishna's, I don't know if we can say this, but he's in a very Vedantic mood as he's talking to Uddhava. Of course, and in response, Uddhava asked this wonderful question we saw several classes ago, and it was profound. Who suffers and who gets enlightened? And Uddhava's thinking goes like this. Your body and mind are insentient stuff. Insentient stuff doesn't get enlightened. Insentient stuff doesn't experience anything. The experience we have is due to consciousness. But now we've got another problem, because consciousness is Satchidananda Atma. Atma suffers? Atma doesn't suffer. If Atma doesn't suffer, Atma doesn't need to get enlightened. Atma doesn't get enlightened. So this is a basis for Uddhava's question, who suffers and who gets enlightened? It's actually a very profound question. And the answer to it is the issue here is that it's not a thing, but rather a combination, an assemblage. Your car is an assemblage of parts, but it won't go anywhere unless you drive it. So you can get the idea. Your body and mind can be considered an assemblage of parts, but it doesn't do anything unless it's in the presence of consciousness. So your car traveling can be considered an assemblage of parts with a driver, and the jiva. We're using jiva now as a technical term in Advaita Vedanta. Jiva is defined as an assemblage of parts, body, mind, senses, together with consciousness. And then there's one more key factor, and that is in amongst all of these parts in the body and mind, there's one tiny little part called ahankara, ego, which let's take it today as self-identification. So amongst all the parts, there's one that's really crucial in our discussion today. And it's the one part that says, I am me. But now the question is, how do you define me? If you define me in terms of the parts, you will suffer. We've been through this before, and we're going to see this in the first verse today. If you identify with the parts, if you define yourself in terms of the parts, I am male. The body is male. Right? I am old. Body is old. I am relaxed. Mind is relaxed. What about me? An enlightened person says, I am Satchidananda Atma. I am pure consciousness. So notice the difference then between a person who suffers and one who is free from suffering is one little part amongst all the all the parts of your bodies. Have you ever looked at an anatomy book? My God, how complicated. And guess what? The most complicated part in that whole anatomy book is your brain. And your mind is born of your complicated brain. How complicated is your mind? Incredibly complicated. And there's one tiny little bit of your mind that says, I am me, and has a definition of who I am. And that's the focal point of our discussion today. With that introduction, we can pick up the thread. Okay. These verses are in the longer meter now. Instead of the 8-syllable meter, we have an 11-syllable meter. Dehendriya pranamano bhimano. Dehendriya prano. Pardon me? Oh, sorry. We got the wrong. Where are we? Oh, there we go. Sorry. No wonder you. I was wondering, why isn't anyone chanting? I can see it very clearly. Let's try that again. Listen and repeat. Dehendriya pranamano bhimano. Dehendriya pranamano bhimano. Jivontaratma guna karma murtihi. Jivontaratma guna karma murtihi. Sutram mahanit Sutram mahanit yurudeva gitaha. Sutram mahanit yurudeva gitaha. Samsara hadhavati kala tantraha. Samsara kala tantraha. I pause because I'm splitting the words as I chant them. And I'm splitting the words mahan, iti, urudha, which is an interesting word. Urudha eva, not urudha eva. Anyway, we'll come to that in just a minute. Start in the second line, jivaha. And again, we're using jiva as a technical term. In common parlance, jiva is a living being. In Vedanta, of course, jiva is a living being. But here, in the context of the individual person, the person who suffers and a person who wants to be free from suffering and gain enlightenment, that is jiva. So who is that jiva? That jiva is, remember we said, it's like your car plus the driver. Your car won't go anywhere without a driver. So here, the jiva has these two same big parts. One is antaratma, the inner self, consciousness, satchidananda, atma, that which gives sentiency to your body and mind. And that antaratma is present, but there is, for the jiva, end of the first line, abhimanaha, identification. Abhimana, it means identification. So this jiva is one who has abhimana, identification, not identification with antaratma. In fact, if you say, I am Satchidananda Atma, and that's your own personal view, that's your well-assimilated knowledge. If you get it, that is, it's not a concept or an idea, but it's your personal truth. One who says, I am Satchidananda Atma, for whom that is a personal, completely realized truth, that person is enlightened. So the identification has been shifted from the body-mind to antaratma. But generally, that's not the case. Generally, that jiva is abhimana, is identified with what? Deha, the physical body, indriya, the senses, sense organs, sight, hearing, etc., prana, the life force within you, and manaha, mind. And what we mean by identification is no one says, I am a physical body. Who says that? Who says, I am sense organs? Who says, I am life force or I am mind? No one says that. That's not the kind of identification we're talking about. The kind of identification we're talking about is more subtle. It's when the attributes of the body, mind, and senses are superimposed. So it's not that the body is superimposed, but the attributes of the body. This is very subtle. See if you can get this easy. Look at this. No one says, I am a body, because I'm more than a body. But you do say, I am male or female. Well, male and female are attributes of the body. So you don't say, I'm a body, but you do say, I am male or female. No one says, I am eyeballs and ears. But you do say, I'm nearsighted. I'm hard of hearing. Attributes of the eyeballs and ears are superimposed. No one says, I am energy, life force. But all the time, one of the things we all hear so often, I'm so tired. Right? Well, wait a minute. That tiredness belongs to prana. And similarly, if you are relaxed or agitated, no one says, I am a mind. But when you say, I'm happy or sad, those are attributes of the mind. So I'm making a subtle distinction here. This is a kind of topic that commentators love to explain in long, detailed Sanskrit commentaries, but it's not hard. What we're superimposing is not the body and mind as a whole, but rather the attributes of the body and mind. So the attributes of the body belong to the body, the attributes of the mind belong to the mind, and not to antaratma, the inner self. But due to this abhimana, this identification, the technical term is superimposition of the attributes. So the attributes of the body and mind are falsely superimposed on atma, which has none of those attributes. But as a result, that antaratma, the inner self, becomes guna karma murti bihi. So the inner self becomes one whose murti, whose form, his nature, is full of gunas and karmas. Gunas, the qualities of the body and mind, and karma as an agent of action. You're the one driving your car? So in this case, consciousness seems to be the one in control of your body and mind. Not in control, but you feel yourself to be an agent of action. I am a doer of action. I do things. So that is the karma. So guna and karma, the qualities of the body and mind are superimposed on atma. So too, the actions of the body and mind are superimposed on atma. Now, I mentioned that this is a very heavy Vedantic chapter, so now he gets quite technical here. Generally, Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita and Uddhava Gita, he generally doesn't get into these technical details, but he does here because he comments that this jiva is urudha eva gitaha. This jiva is gitaha. Not if you want a literal translation, it's silly. The jiva is gitaha, sung about, huh? We're not singing. So declared. You need a proper translation for each word in context. So the jiva is gitaha. It is declared urudha eva in many ways. Uru means many. Urudha eva in many ways with many names such as sutra and mahan. These are highly technical terms. Sutratma. You may have come across that. Sutratma, sutratma. It's a technical term. And mahan or mahat is the undeclined form here. These are highly technical terms to talk about jiva in particular situations. For example, right now, the jiva sitting in your seat is endowed with a physical body. The name for the jiva sitting in your seat in the waking state, endowed with a physical body, the technical name for that one is mahat, or more commonly vishwa. If you've studied like Tattva Bodha and these other technical texts, you may have heard it called vishwa. Also Mandukya Upanishad, I think, uses that terminology. So mahat or vishwa is a technical term for jiva in the waking state endowed with a body, which means there must be a jiva in the dream state not endowed with a physical body. Difference, right? In the waking state, you have a physical body. In the dream state, you don't experience your physical body. The name for jiva in the dream state without a physical body is sutram, sutratma. More commonly called taijasa is another technical term used for it. So these distinctions are made about jiva. We know jiva, and if you say, why are we doing this hair splitting? People will complain. And I agree. There is a lot of hair splitting in more detailed texts on Advaita Vedanta. But here, it's making a very good, very important observation. You suffer in the waking state. You can also suffer in your dreams. So there's suffering for jiva, both in the waking state and dream state. What about deep sleep, dreamless sleep? Any suffering? What do we experience in deep sleep? Bliss. Blissful sleep. So that's a very different. Now he concludes here by saying, this jiva, nice expression, adhavati, this is the last line, this jiva adhavati runs about, literally what it means, adhavati, it runs here and there. Where? Samsare, the A drops due to grammar rules, in the world of suffering, just world. The samsare adhavati. This jiva runs about in the world, and very easily we can tack on one of our favorite observations, and that is the jiva runs about in the world compelled by, you can answer that question, you can fill in the blank, compelled by blank and blank. Raga and dvesha. So under the compulsion of raga and dvesha, this jiva is, you know, raga and dvesha wouldn't be so bad if it were more fun. It's not always so much fun. Even the good stuff. You have a good day at work. You come home, I'm so tired, right? You had a good day at work, and yet you're tired. And if you had a bad day at work, how much worse it is. So my point is, running around in the world wouldn't be so bad if it were more fun. But the truth of the matter is, it's not all. There are moments of fun, absolutely. Thank goodness. Otherwise, you know, somebody very sarcastically said, Good thing there are a few moments of fun here and there, otherwise we would all commit suicide. What a grim observation. I don't think it's entirely true, but you get the point. So the jiva runs about samsare in the world driven by raga and dvesha. Where do these raga and dvesha come from? You know, they're kind of normal, right? We're all born unenlightened, meaning identified with the body and mind, meaning not recognizing our true nature as Satchidananda Atma. And the fact is that the failure to recognize your innate fullness, completeness, your innate divinity, your failure to recognize your innate divine nature is the root cause for raga and dvesha. If you knew I am Satchidananda Atma, why would you be compelled by raga and dvesha? There's nothing that you need to get. There's nothing that you need to get away from. So that compulsivity can be traced to non-recognition of your true self, which we're all born with. And that's how Sri Krishna concludes this. He says that jiva is kala tantraha. Here, tantra means controlled by. Every word has different meanings in different contexts. Here it means controlled. Controlled. So controlled by kala, time. And here time is a code word for karma. Wait, Sanskrit is like that. You have to, and by the way, even English is like that, right? You know, if you don't know the context, a lot of English words have so many subtle meanings. If you don't know if you really don't know the context, you can easily misinterpret anything in any language, not just Sanskrit. So here, kala means karma. So kala tantraha means due to the effects of karma. And what is the sense here? Why did you get born? With ignorance, to be driven by compulsions, to run about, you run around like, what do they say? These American metaphors are terrible, sorry. But the American saying is to run around like a chicken with his head cut off, because just about 100 years ago, families had a little farm or maybe some background. They had chickens in the backyard. And so what do you do at dinner time? You think about it. Just 100, 200 years ago, dinner time. So, by the way, it's usually the woman of the house who would do this also. She would go out her back door, grab one of those chickens, chop off its head. Now, that chicken isn't ready to go into the pot yet. Why? What happens after you cut off the head of the chicken? Honestly, the impulses in the nerves, I think. That chicken runs or flops around, does different things. Only after it calms down, then she's got to rip. Can you imagine living 200 years ago? Chop off the head, rip off all the... And it's not even vegetarian. You can't eat it. Anyway. All of this is because of that ugly metaphor, like a chicken with its head cut off. And the sense of that metaphor is mindlessly. The chicken runs around mindlessly. When you are compelled by raga and dvesha, are you mindful of dharma or are you not mindful of dharma? The very definition of compulsion is that you're not mindful. You're not in complete control of yourself. You are compelled. You are driven by your desires. You are driven by these forces of raga and dvesha. So you are born not recognizing your true nature. therefore, identified with the body and mind, therefore, finding so many things you need, things that you need to get, things that you're compelled to get, and things that you're compelled to run away from, and therefore you are running about them. This is a word, adhavati, running about in life like that poor chicken. My gosh, what an example. Okay, so kala tantraha, due to karma. And oh, there's a very sarcastic ending to this story, and that is you run around like a chicken with its head cut off for 70, 80 some years, and then what? You die. And then what? You get born again, and you do it all over again. That's what Sri Krishna means to suggest by that word kala tantraha, driven by the force of karma. Next.
Amulam etat bahurupa rupitam. Amulam etat bahurupa rupitam. Manovacha prana sharira karma. Manovacha prana sharira karma. Jnana sino pasana yashitena. Jnana sino pasana yashitena. Chitva munir gam vicharat yatrishnaha. Chitva munir gam vicharat yatrishnaha.
Okay, where to start? First line, skip the first word. Etat, this. What is our context? Jiva. Etat, jiva. This jiva is bahurupa rupitam. It is rupitam. It is formed of bahurupa, many parts, let us say. This jiva consists of many parts. So body, mind, senses. And even though we can't really say Atma is a part, it's still an element that's part of the equation, so to speak. So the jiva is a complex being, an assembly of parts. And that jiva, which is an assembly of parts, what are those parts? In the second line, manas, mind, vachaha, the organ of speech, the capacity for speech. Prana, life force, as we saw before. Sharira, physical body. And karma, the actions of each of these. The actions of the mind, the actions of speech, action of prana, action of the body. All of this makes up the assemblage of parts called jiva. And Sri Krishna uses a very strong word here. He says, that jiva is amulam. Literally, has no root. Contextually, has no reality. And this is an unusual word. It's an important observation. Sri Krishna, just to paraphrase him, he's saying the jiva doesn't exist. Huh? What do you mean, jiva doesn't exist? Well, each of the parts exist. So the body exists as a lump of fat. The mind exists as all the features we know about the mind. Consciousness exists. But where does the jiva come from? This is subtle, but you'll get it. If I say, I am Swami Taratmananda, the status of being Swami Taratmananda, is the body Swami Taratmananda? This is logic, by the way, just two more minutes of pure logic to understand this. Which is Swami Taratmananda? Is it the physical body? Not exactly, right? Is it the prana? Is it the sense organs are Swami Taratmananda? And the idea is that the body alone, if the body is Taratmananda, then without anything else, in other words, without sense organs, without prana, in other words, shava, when you know, one day when his body is horizontal and cold, will you say that's Taratmananda? No one will say that's Taratmananda. It's a corpse. So this physical body is not Taratmananda. What about the prana? Well, prana is not Taratmananda. What about the sense organs, eyes and ears? Not Taratmananda. What about mind? Mind is a faculty, right? A power that you use, like sight is a faculty you use. Mind is a faculty you use. Intellect is a faculty you use. So therefore, mind is not Taratmananda. Sense is not Taratmananda. Intellect, I wanted to come to, is not Taratmananda. Now, where is Taratmananda? Oh, consciousness. Wait a minute. Consciousness is just unchanging, the unchanging observer of the activities of the mind. This is one of many definitions. If we understand consciousness to be unchanging and a mere observer, is that Taratmananda? Here's something. Who gets named? So at birth, I was given one name. In 1993, I was given the name Taratmananda. Who was given the name Taratmananda? It was given to whom? Given by Puja Swami Dayananda, obviously. Given to whom? To a body? To a mind? To consciousness? Who is Taratmananda? This is logic. There is no Taratmananda. From just using strict rules of logic, Taratmananda is an idea, a mere idea. How real is an idea? Not that real. That's why Krishna says amulam here. He says that this jiva, here, try this to make it easier for you to understand. So not in 1993, let's go for 1953. Gosh, that sounds like a long time ago now. So in 1953, a child was born, and most of you know that child was given the name Mark. So to whom was that name given? Body? Mind? Senses? Of course, parents didn't understand Satchidananda Atma. But so here's the point. The assemblage becomes a new entity. I'm grasping to make this logic more clear to you. How about there is a philosophical perspective called deconstruction. And you show your car to this deconstructionist and say, how do you like my car? The deconstructionist says, what car? Because the deconstructionist only sees parts, tires, chassis, steering wheel, plastic, steel, metal, all of this stuff. So the deconstructionist doesn't see a car. You see a car. You have a concept in your mind of car. You get into it and drive it. The deconstructionist looks upon it in a completely different way. So this is the use of logic to deconstruct the jiva and show the jiva is not a real entity. So when Sri Krishna says amulam, he is making that point. Not a real entity, an idea. And for that reason, enlightenment is possible. If you were truly a jiva, that is, if you were truly, the metaphor, if you are really like the person driving your car, if that's our definition of jiva, and it's a wrong definition of jiva, but then you're stuck. If you are inside your body, logic. Let me stop. And anyway, I hope you get my point that using this principle of logical deconstruction, we can demonstrate that jiva as an assemblage is not absolutely real. And I think because it's such a logical topic, I think we'll set it aside at this point. Now, here's the significance, and as Sri Krishna goes on here, he says, since that word amulam is really important, I guess what I was trying to say a moment ago, if the one who suffers is absolutely real, there's no solution. If the one who suffers is real, that one is going to run around through the world for 70, 80 years, and then fall over dead. That's just what it is. But suppose that one is not absolutely real. Then there's a solution. What is the problem? The problem is that, as we saw in a prior verse, identification. You assume that the attributes of the body and mind, are superimposed on your true nature, on pure consciousness. All of that suffering takes place due to the failure, as I said before, due to the failure to recognize your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, the failure to recognize your innate divinity, your innate fullness, completeness, perfection. Failing to recognize your innate perfection, definitely you will run around compelled by raga and dvesha. So how do we free ourselves from that compulsion? We have to recognize your true nature. Why don't you recognize your true nature? We've had this discussion in so many ways. The so-called veil of ignorance. We are all born ignorant. We are born unenlightened. We are born into a life of suffering, and we have to come out of it. How? How do we come out of it? If the problem is, to use my guru's language, if the problem is self non-recognition, I like his language, the failure to recognize your innate divinity. If the problem is self non-recognition, what is the solution? Now, we can say the solution is self-recognition, which means what? Knowledge. If the problem is ignorance, the solution is knowledge. And that's what Sri Krishna talks about here. He says, jnanasina, and then in the third line, chitwa munihi. Fourth line. Look at the fourth line. Chitwa munihi. Muni, a wise person. A wise person, chitwa, having cut away that ignorance. How do you cut away ignorance? Jnana, asina. With the asi, with the sword of jnana. We've heard that before in the Bhagavad Gita. And here he uses it again. Jnana asi, the sword of knowledge. It's a beautiful metaphor. Obviously, knowledge is the solution to the problem of identification with your body, mind, etc., etc. And the sword of knowledge can certainly destroy ignorance, but there's a problem. Have you ever taken a knife, and one maybe a really old knife that you haven't used for a long time, and you try to, I'm trying to think of what would be a good example. You're trying to use that knife to maybe take the skin off an apple, as an example. But it's a really old knife, and it's really dull. And you're really, you'd think to get the skin off an apple, not a big deal. But this knife is so old and dull, it can't cut a thing. If you're trying to cut carrots, it'll go chunk. And it won't go through because it's so dull. So that sword of knowledge has to be sharp. And here, Sri Krishna makes this beautiful, beautiful observation. How do you sharpen, this is metaphor, right? How do you sharpen the sword of knowledge? He says, upasnaya shitena. When that sword of knowledge is shitena, is sharpened, how? Upasanaya, upasana here is bhakti. The sword of knowledge sharpened by bhakti. What a lovely metaphor. Because it shows the intimate relationship between jnana and bhakti. You've heard me complain about people talk about the path of jnana or the path of bhakti. And I complain about people who use that language because you don't get to choose one or the other. I'm trying to think of how to mix my metaphors here. I should probably avoid doing that. So here's the point. If knowledge destroys ignorance, but if the sword of knowledge is dull, meaning the knowledge we gain from these scriptures, from our gurus, from all of our sadhana, if the knowledge we gain is not very clear, is not well understood, and is not well assimilated, could we not say that, the knowledge is dull, so to speak? So dull knowledge is like the unsharpened sword, the dull sword. So what do you need to do to get that knowledge to sink in? That knowledge needs to be made very sharp. Meaning your mind has to be sharp. Your mind has to be capable of wielding the sword of knowledge. How to make the mind capable, how to become an adhikari, to use our Vedantic language. And you can answer that question now. Bhakti is crucial to prepare you, to make you an adhikari, because without being an adhikari, qualified student, prepared student, without being a prepared student, that sort of knowledge will not work. So it shows a relationship here between bhakti and knowledge. Do you get to choose one and not the other? You need both. You need the sword of knowledge, but it has to be sharp. So you need both jnana and bhakti. You don't get to choose. So when that wise person has cut away the ignorance with that sword of knowledge, which has been sharpened by bhakti, then what? Gam vicharati atrishnaha. Then, vicharati, he wanders, gam, the world. He wanders the world, atrishnaha, free from desire, uncompelled by raga dvesha. it's interesting to compare the last line of these two verses. So look at the last line here. The ignorant person, what does the ignorant person do? Adhavati samsare, runs around in samsara, driven by raga and dvesha. What does the enlightened person do? Vicharati, moves about gam in the world, atrishnaha, without desire, not compelled by raga, dvesha, and fully satisfied, completely content. Okay, let's see just one more verse. Jnanam viveko nigamastapascha. Jnanam viveko nigamastapascha. Pratyakshamai tihyamatanumanam. Pratyakshamai tihyamatatmanam. Adhyantayorasya yadeva kevalam. Adyantayorasya yaraiva kevalam kalascha hetuscha tadeva madhye kalascha hetuscha tadeva madhye. Okay, how will you get that knowledge? We said the sharpened sword of knowledge. How do you get that sharpened sword of knowledge? We've already said the sword of knowledge is sharpened by bhakti, but how do you get the knowledge itself? And he says, you get that knowledge, jnanam, through viveka, discernment, proper discernment. In fact, Vedanta begins with that discernment. I am the knower, everything else is known. This is where Vedanta begins. I am me. Things are not me. What a wonderful, brilliant place to begin this process of self-inquiry, this discernment. In technical texts, they'll say you have to discern the difference between sat and asat, that which is real and that which is unreal. And that ends up being, as I said, the discernment between I and not I. That is viveka. But not just viveka. Viveka means this, the term you've heard me use more often is vichara, inquiry. That's really the sense of it here. Atma vichara, self-inquiry. But we've also discussed how any process of self-inquiry needs proper guidance. Where does that guidance come from? Nigama. Nigama is a word for scripture. Shastra. Nigama and shastra are synonyms. So you get it from shastra. You get it also from tapaha, austerity. What is the austerity? The austerity is sitting through a long class. How's that? It takes effort. I know that. How many classes like this do you think I've sat through? You get the point. So it takes effort, absolutely. It takes effort. Austerity, I don't think, you know, I'm not, anyway, we'll set fasting and all these ritualistic kinds of tapas aside. Just effort, and in the sense of tapas. Also, how do we gain knowledge? Well, certainly through pratyaksham, perception, what we experience in our day-to-day lives, and the most, just an interesting observation. The most important thing, this is an interesting observation. I never thought about it. People think that you need a special spiritual experience to gain enlightenment. And we've had this discussion before, and that's not true. You don't need a special experience. Your ordinary experience is enough. And there's one particular ordinary experience that's crucial amongst all the experiences we have in life. There is one particular experience without which you'll never be enlightened. Think about, get the gravity of what I'm saying. There is one ordinary worldly experience that is crucial, essential to gaining enlightenment. If you've never had this one experience, you will never get enlightened. What is that one experience? Suffering. Think about it. If you have never suffered, would you be sitting here today? If you've never suffered, moksha has no value, has no meaning. Our ordinary experience of suffering is adequate to put you on the path to moksha and to encourage you to go all the way to the end of that path, to become free from suffering. So therefore, pratyaksham, literally perception, but in this case, worldly experience. Also, we get, go to the end, atta anumanam, also inference. Of course, inference in the sense of the logic we were trying to use before to deconstruct your car into parts, to deconstruct a jiva into a pile of parts. So we use anumana, various kinds of logic. And one more thing we draw upon kind of goes along with nigama, with scripture. What goes along with scripture is aitihyam, is tradition. Aitihyam as in itihasa, has the same root. How can we say oral traditions, teachings which have been passed down from person to person, like our stories. Just to make the point, in what scripture is the rope snake metaphor found? In what scripture do you find the rope snake metaphor? Nope, not in any scripture. But we use it all the time. That is aitihyam, part of our tradition, an oral tradition where it's been passed down. So all of this, and of course, all of this is necessary for jnanam, and then you need bhakti for sharpening the sword of knowledge. You need bhakti for preparation, and then you need jnanam to cut away the ignorance. Now here's a very important point. Do you get to choose? How about, should you, I'll turn it into a question. What is most important? Is viveka most important, self-inquiry? Is nigama, scripture, most important? Is tapas, effort, most important? Is pratyaksha, worldly experience, most important? Is aitihyam, most important, tradition, stories? Or is anumanam most important? You can answer that question. They're all important. We need them all. This idea that you get to pick and choose strikes me as a very postmodern perspective. You know, who said you get to pick and choose? We need all of it. You've heard me say we need all the help we can get, right? This is not an ordinary pursuit. We need all the help we can get, so we need all of these. And with all of these, then what? Adyantayoho asya yadeva kevalam. What remains when you cut away identification with your body and mind, with the sword of knowledge, which has been sharpened by bhakti, what remains, yadeva kevalam, that alone remains, which is your essence, as Satchidananda Atma, Antaratma was used before. What remains is your essence, the essence because of which the jiva has an adya and an adi and anta. the birth and death of a jiva depends on consciousness. A baby is born as a sentient being. Consciousness. But the trick here is that consciousness existed before birth. That consciousness existed before conception. The consciousness existed before the parents looked to speak. That consciousness, as we've discussed before, is a fundamental reality. We all think about consciousness in very experiential terms. Here, Sri Krishna is talking about that consciousness as a fundamental reality, the fundamental reality because of which the jiva has adi and anta, has birth and death. And not only that, the jiva also has tadeva, in the last line, tadeva madhye, and that consciousness or fundamental reality, that madhye, during the existence of the jiva, it's responsible for kala, time, again, karma. The karmas that affect us in life and hetu, I'm going to talk for hours about this, worldly life, karma, karmas from past lives, kala, and hetu, karmas from this life. I'm simplifying it here because we don't want a long discussion here at the end of the class. But worldly life is a result of karma, but not just karmas from last life, karmas from this life. Kala represents karmas from past lives. Hetu, cause, represents karmas from this life. So in the last half of this verse, Sri Krishna says that after you cut away the ignorance with that sharpened sword of knowledge, which means you get it. I am pure consciousness, Satchidananda Atma, utterly unaffected by the problems of the body, mind, and world around me. And in that way, Yadeva Kevalam. You come to understand your nature Kevalam. Only, literally only, as you truly are, in your essential nature, the essence of who you are, the fundamental reality because of which you exist as a conscious being. Sri Krishna here describes enlightenment. Good place to stop. We'll continue next week. Let's see. Oh, announcement, an important announcement is, I mentioned before, we've resumed our advanced meditation class. So next session is this coming Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. Come and join us. Also, our classes tomorrow, Vedanta class at 10 and Satsang at 11. Check your email. We don't know if it's going to be snow and ice or if it'll be melted by tomorrow morning. Basically, if you look outside and everything is white, chances are our class will be canceled. But the way to be sure, suppose it's partially white, then check your email. If we cancel the class, we'll send out an email and let you know. Okay, we'll conclude with our prayers.
Om Ganana Hantwa Ganapatigam Avamahe Kavinga Vinam Upamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanas Patahanashranvan Utibhisira Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Guru Ratmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyoma Vadvyapta Dehaya Dakshinamurtaye namaha Vasudevasutam devam Kamsachanuramardhanam Devaki paramanandam Krishnam vande jagadgurum Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah Sarve santu niramayah Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kashchid dukkabhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityor ma amritangamaya Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat.